No, he's the man who rose to prominence as Tony Blair's chief spin doctor, was at Labour Prime Minister's side, wasn't he, for most of his time in Number 10. Of course, it's Alistair Campbell we're talking about. He's released the sixth volume of his diaries detailing the latter years of that relationship and his own struggle to cut his ties to government. Alistair, good morning.
Hi, Stephen. How are you?
I'm doing all right. So how are you doing this weather?
I'm okay.
Good.
Just been through a bit of a bad patch on the head front, but I'm okay.
Are you missing the power that's associated with government?
Well, it's a long time since I left, to be honest. And I mean, I'm missing the sense of having a government that sort of knew what it was doing vaguely. I worry about a lot of the things that are happening in the UK, not least in your part of the UK. And I'm absolutely passionately engaged in trying to make the country have another little think about Brexit.
What are you worried? Well, let's talk about both. Two of the things you mentioned there. What are you worried about Northern Ireland specifically?
I just think there's a lot of stuff bubbling under the surface, and I think that Brexit, there's a danger that Brexit will bring those closer to the fore. And I worry that the British government is so consumed with Brexit, in particular the politics of Brexit over here with this sort of latest psychodrama with Boris Johnson and Theresa May, that there's a danger they take their eye off the ball.
So we've got in Northern Ireland today the European Parliament's Brexit negotiator,
yep.
Guy Verhofstadt, if I have pronounced that even close to properly.
Yeah, yeah.
And he has said that it's up to the UK to, he said this morning, it's up to the UK to find a way to avoid new controls on the Irish border. And he said, I hear some people say it's easy. I'm quoting him here. Northern Ireland can continue to be part of the customs union and single market and the problem is solved. He says, but the point is, it's the UK government who have to come forward with a proposal as the problem has been created by the decision by the UK to leave the union. Well, how would you react to that? And what is the solution?
Well, I don't know. And one other thing, I think we spoke about this during the referendum. I mean, it just the extent to which during the referendum campaign, the leavers and particularly kind of, you know, the glibness of Boris Johnson, these were problems that they said would go away. We didn't need to worry about them. I mean, Verhofstadt is right. We have given them this problem. And I don't know is the answer to your question. How do you have a frictionless border? And he's also right, by the way, if Theresa May had not got into this position where the single market and the customs union were some kind of red line, she hasn't even tried to negotiate around that. Is there a way of leaving the European Union but staying in the single market and the customs union? I don't know. But is there at least a possibility that we might have a government that would try to explore that? So I'd look for Verhofstadt as a bit of a bogeyman when it comes to parts of the right wing in our politics and the media. And, you know, I think it's fair to say, you know, given that Britain stopped him getting one of the top jobs in the past, he probably doesn't feel that warmly towards us. But he's right. And what I worry about with this, we're into this 2-year process. The three big things that Barnier has set out as the kind of, you know, the issues that have to be resolved, the rights of EU citizens living here and UK citizens living there, the border issue and the bill, we're not that further forward. And look, I'll be, you know, in the years covered by the diaries that you mentioned, I've been involved in all sorts of difficult and tense negotiations with the rest of the European Union. But I sort of feel in this one that it's kind of going nowhere. And if we come out without a deal, I'm telling you, it's an utter catastrophe for us.
Tell me why. What's the catastrophe?
Well, I see a catastrophe. Look, you know, I was in France over the summer. And they've got a friend down there who's British and his wife's British, but they've got a daughter that they're raising there who goes to French school. And she showed me this map that they'd given to kids about the new Europe. And they had all the flags of all the European countries. We were just a white blob, and Northern Ireland an even smaller part of the white blob. And you see Ireland out there effectively would be on its own. Lost its most important ally in the European Union. I think at a time when you've got China, you've got Trump in America, you've got Russia, a much more aggressive foreign policy, We need allies. We need allies politically. We need allies economically. And we're turning our backs on them. We might pretend that we've got this, you know, because we've got our great history and because Britain's had all these, you know, survived in the war and all the rest of it. But we are turning our backs. We're becoming more isolationist. We're becoming more inward looking at a time when we need to be looking out. And I don't think there's a country in history, democracy or dictatorship, that has built success by governing against the interests of young people. And most young people think what we're doing is an act of self-mutilation.
Well, they had a chance to vote and didn't.
Some did, some didn't. I agree, a lot didn't. And I think regretted that. But even you can't, you know, I do wish we had compulsory voting in significant elections, local and national, and referendum particularly. But I think that where we are now, yes, we voted June the 23rd, 2016, to come out of the European Union. But I think people are beginning to realise that in terms of the value of the pound, the prices of things in the shops, the power that we have in the world, the mess of these negotiations, I think at least people ought to be able to have pause to reflect about it. And once we see the nature of the deal, let's just see where public opinion is there.
Well, you're going down the line that your man Tony Blair has gone down. In fact, he's gone further, hasn't he? He wants a whole rethink. He wants us to stop what people voted for in the referendum.
That's not democratic,
is it?
Well, democracy, Stephen, democracy is not a moment in time. Democracy is a process. And I'm simply saying, as we go through that process, I bumped into somebody the other day, okay, and it's true, I was on Piers Morgan's show this morning, and Piers said that, you know, he hasn't met anybody who voted Leave and has changed their minds. Well, I've met people who are at least reflecting that maybe what they were promised is not now happening. Where is that extra money for the health service? Where is this frictionless border that we were told was going to be so simple? Where are these amazing trade deals that we're going to do with the rest of the world overnight?
Where's the world imploding as people who wanted us to stay in Europe predicted would happen if we didn't?
I didn't say it was going to implode, but I did say I thought we would go into relative decline pretty quickly, and I think that's happening. I think it's happening economically, and I think it's happening politically. We're becoming seen in a very different way by the rest of the world. Now, you may think that's not important, but I think it is important. I think that Britain and the action that it's taken in voting, even the act of the referendum itself, I think has damaged us. Now, does that mean that we're going to disappear as a country? Of course it doesn't. But this idea of global Britain that Theresa May talks about, we're not seen as a serious country at the moment. And so I'm not saying that it's going to be, you know, Armageddon.
We're not seen as a serious country, given the power we have and how much
that
we
import. That power is diminishing, Stephen. That power is diminishing. And we've just got to be honest about that.
Well,
we're
kidding
ourselves.
People like you talk the country down.
I'm going to say what I think. And it's not a question of talking the country. Why should I get behind a government as dysfunctional and as useless as this one? Why should I pretend that Theresa May and Boris Johnson and David Davis and Liam Fox, given that I've worked with prime ministers and ministers who actually, whatever people think about them, are competent, know how to get things done?
Yeah.
What are they achieving?
Because many people think
right
Corbyn
now?
Is a prime minister in waiting, don't they? Because many people think Corbyn would really be able to look after this country and have a coherent team behind him.
I was talking about Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, Stephen. And I'm simply saying, when you talk about this, is what's fascinating about the Brexit debate is that people on the Brexit side are no longer saying, let's do this because it's going to be great for Britain. They're saying, let's do it because we voted for it on June the 23rd, 2016. They've lost the argument already. And so I'm simply saying, I believe that people who've got a voice and who get asked onto programmes like yours, I think we should say what we think. I think this is a catastrophe for Britain. I think it's a catastrophe for Northern Ireland, by the way, because I think that because of the Brexit bandwidth, you're already being pushed to the back of the queue in terms of what government priorities are. I think that I was in Dublin last week, and there was a guy at a dinner I was at who was making the point. He says, this is going to be bad for you. He said, it's going to be even worse for us because economically we're probably going to take an even bigger hit. And what's more, he made the point, we, the Irish, are losing our closest and biggest ally in the European Union. That's dangerous for Ireland.
Let me bring this and focus this on Northern Ireland for the next 5 minutes or so. So in terms of the peace process we have, and I want to talk to you about the lack of government in Northern Ireland in a moment and your thoughts around that. But in terms of Brexit, do you think it is endangering the peace process in Northern Ireland?
I think it has the potential to.
In what way? Surely the violence is gone forever.
Well, I hope so. I certainly hope
so. So how does it endanger it?
I'll give you one example out of what... So Theresa May becomes Prime Minister on the back of the referendum. Okay, David Cameron, I think he was wrong to have the referendum. He loses the referendum. He goes, she becomes Prime Minister. She then does this deal with the DUP. And I thought that of itself was posed a risk to the politics that surround the peace process. Because as you know, when the peace process is in trouble, as it is now, with the institutions, as you say, not operating, then the British and Irish governments become the negotiators, the arbiters. How can you be the arbiter and the negotiator when your entire political survival is dependent on the support of one side? That has a dynamic to it. So you're right, at the moment, things are peaceful, relatively, but those tensions can emerge, could re-emerge, unless governments and unless public opinion stays very, very focused.
What tensions could re-emerge?
Well,
You really think there could be peace? We will never go back to where we were, Alistair.
No, I'm not saying you go back to where you were. I'm simply saying don't take things for granted. And that, I thought, just as I think that the current difficulties going on between Theresa May and Boris Johnson now are all part of the kind of psychodrama of the Tory party in Europe, I thought the fact that she had to do that deal with the DUP was wrong. I think it potentially puts a pressure on the peace process. Is not static. You say we never go back. Well, hopefully we never go back, but don't ever imagine that it always goes forward. That's all I'm saying. And I think that in the whole point of the Brexit, the way that they handle it, they're delusional. They live in a dream world about how this thing's going to play out. That is all I'm saying.
What the DUP would say, you mentioned them, they would say that they have secured, you know, £1 billion, £1.5 billion in total, but £1 billion of money to spend for everyone in Northern Ireland. Now, mm-hmm. that money hasn't been forthcoming yet. And indeed, the solicitor for the government, some Treasury solicitor, essentially said that there was no timetable around it being delivered. Mm-hmm. Do you think the DUP should up the ante and say, given the leverage they have with the government, and say, we want the money now?
Well, that's for them to make a judgment as to how they do that. I think even the fact that you phrase the question in those terms, though, underlines the nature of a deal that is, to the rest of the country, just seems a bit wrong, frankly. You talk about them getting £1 billion by doing this deal. Well, that's money that's going to be taken away from other parts of the United Kingdom, other parts of services. And this is what I mean about the way this Brexit process has been done. It's like it's just the latest chapter in a drama about the survival of the Tory party and the successive Tory leaders. And it's interesting, you know, that the book that I've published this week, as you say, is 2005-2007. It actually covers, Theresa May's not in it, Jeremy Corbyn's not in it, just shows you how much the world has changed and how quickly. But David Cameron and George Osborne are starting to emerge, and it actually covers the period where Cameron becomes Prime Minister. And he founded on Europe. I think Theresa May is probably going to go the same way. And they're just about, they've never been able to resolve this issue. And I don't know where it goes. And we're, you know, the Labour Party, we're divided as well. There's no doubt about it. I'm not happy with the way Jeremy Corbyn is not actually bothering that much with the Brexit issue. Two prime ministers questioned since the summer of chaos in the negotiations, hasn't even, the word Brexit has not passed his lips. So
do you think Jeremy Corbyn would be a better prime minister than Theresa May?
Well, I voted Labour at the last election. I'm not going to pretend that I've... That
it's not
I've,
my question.
Well, it's not the choice we've got as we speak.
It's not my question.
Look, I'm not going to pretend that I think he's... I don't have severe doubts. I do.
Yeah?
But I'd always rather...
Do you think Corbyn would make a better Prime Minister than Theresa May?
I'd always rather have a Labour government than a Tory government. I'm not going to pretend I don't have doubts, but I have massive doubts about this government and their ability to take us through the
Brexit
process.
At the two individuals, who would make the better Prime Minister?
I think I probably would go with Jeremy Corbyn because I think she's terrible. But I think Jeremy Corbyn, in relation to some of his foreign policy positions, some of his economic policy positions, I have a lot of difficulty with them.
We will, of course, talk about that period in the book in a moment, but you will understand why I'm looking for a lot of your insight into Northern Ireland. It's a Northern Irish show. Yeah. And we do not have a government in Northern Ireland because of this impasse. And Sinn Féin are saying that unless they get a standalone Irish language act in Northern Ireland, they are not forming a government anymore. Unless there is same-sex marriage, they will not form a government. And Arlene Foster, former First Minister, leader of the DUP, as you know, she is saying that this demand from Sinn Féin for a standalone Irish Language Act is designed to humiliate unionists and to humiliate people who have a British way of life. Mm. We're back to very tense stuff in Northern
That's
Ireland.
That's what I was saying to you earlier, and you were disputing that.
What if you were still in government with Tony Blair? What would you be doing? How would you be trying to bring these parties who are possibly getting further apart as each day goes on? What would you be doing?
Well, I think that I don't know. I know James Brokenshire a little bit. I don't know him very well. I bumped into him at Martin McGuinness's funeral. People say that he's as the standard of Tory ministers go, that he's one of the better ones. But ultimately, I do think when these tensions get to up to the not boiling point, but start to think that they might get there, then I think one of the lessons that from our time and also from John Major's time is that when that happens, then there has to be real leadership from the top. And so this is why I say that the Brexit bandwidth problem, it is a real issue. There are only so many big things at one time that a prime minister can really devote energy to. And she's so consumed with this Brexit stuff that I don't think Northern Ireland really is on her radar, and it needs to be. So when you say what needs to be done, I think there has to be an acknowledgement of the problem that you're identifying. Now, here I am. I'm sitting in Millbank in London. There's very little. There's not even awareness of this as an issue in the rest of the UK at the moment.
But what does that say?
What it says is what I've said to you. What it says is that people are taking the peace process for granted, and it says that it's not a priority for the UK government at a time when they're trying to make sense of this madness of Brexit. That's what it says.
But how and why should Northern Ireland not be a priority for the UK government, given the alternative that you see if there is not stability here?
I agree.
And waiting lists are going through the roof in Northern Ireland, and people are going to be dramatically affected by having no government here.
And the UK government, dependent for its survival and longevity on the biggest party there. I mean, it's crazy, but that is the situation that we're in. I mean, you're preaching to the converted here, Stephen. It should be priority. These questions about the border, about the relationship between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK and Northern Ireland and Ireland, they should have been part of the referendum debate. They weren't. They were waved away. I went over to Dublin a couple of times and I said to the Irish business community, you need to get more stuck into this debate. Said to the Irish government, this is going to have a massive... Somebody last week, they used the phrase collateral damage. Said we're going to be collateral damage in your damn referendum. I think that's true. And so, listen, we're on the same page here. I think it's a scandal that the British government, the UK government, is not focused more on this as a problem.
And Labour are hardly raising it, are they?
No.
They don't seem to care to the extent that maybe it is needed either in terms of profile, in terms of shouting from the rooftops.
I agree. I agree, but that's because Brexit is dominant in the political debate. And Jeremy Corbyn, I said earlier, he doesn't really go on about Brexit. He goes on about this whole austerity agenda, which is important, about the pay cap, that's important. These things are important. But look, I'm with you on this. Yeah. I think that, you know, when I look back over the time with Tony Blair, I think what we did and what he did and Bertie Ahern and his team did in Northern Ireland was one of the most significant and important things that we did.
Yeah, but there are questions for Blair and indeed for you, because, you know, if we look at this impasse we have with the Irish Language Act in Northern Ireland, it actually does trace back possibly to you and Blair, because the DUP claim that it was Tony Blair who agreed to an Irish Language Act, not them. And that there was skullduggery in there, some commentators saying that it wasn't made clear who was agreeing. So was it you and Blair who agreed to the Irish Language Act, and did you not tell the DUP at the time?
Well, if we did, and it's not in a one of the previous volumes of my diaries, I don't recall it, put it that way.
You don't recall what?
I don't recall that we did that, and I don't recall that, as it were, we said to one side, this is going to happen, to the other side, no, it's not. I don't recall that.
Agreed to an Irish Language Act, you would recall it, surely?
Not necessarily, no. No.
Okay.
I wouldn't necessarily recall it. And one of the reasons I keep a diary is because I don't actually have a great memory. If it's in the diaries covering that period, then I honestly don't know, Stephen. I don't know. I can't recall. But and certainly there were times in the negotiations when, and you know, one of the previous books I wrote just about the peace process, and there were times, and I think we all know this from negotiations, where you might emphasise one thing to one side of the talks that you're engaged in, and another thing to another side, and people are aware of that. That's how negotiations sometimes work.
Yeah, but the problem where we're currently at is that Sinn Féin feel that they had a genuine commitment to an Irish Language Act, and that has not been honoured. Meanwhile, you've got the other big party, the DUP, saying they never agreed to it.
Mm. Yeah, well, and they're going to have to. My point is that that's where they are. We've had many, many moments like this in the past, both before and during and since the Good Friday Agreement. And at that time, government has to lead the attempt to try to resolve what are clearly big difficulties, and that's where we are now.
You mentioned young people earlier on, and I was down at a youth event last Friday. Mm-hmm. When they were campaigning and talking to each other, lots of young people talking to each other about their Vote 16 campaign.
Yeah.
Where do you stand on that? Do you think they have the maturity to vote at 16?
Well, I was involved a bit in the Scottish referendum campaign. I thought one of the best things about it was the fact that 16 and kids aged 16 to 18 had the vote. I thought it really was a positive thing, and I would support it. Listen, Stephen, as you well know, there are people of your age and my age who, frankly, you know, you. I remember the day after the referendum, I bumped into somebody, and she could see I was a bit down. She said, "Oh, it's terrible, isn't it?" I said, "Yeah, I'm really a bit down about it." And she said, "Yeah, yeah." She said, "And, you know, I feel really bad, and I voted leave." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "I didn't realise if we left, it meant we had to, if I voted leave, it meant we had to leave." And I thought, "Wow." Now there will be 16 and 17 year olds who aren't that mature, to use your phrase, who don't necessarily follow politics as closely as you and I might, but I feel they give a perspective on the world that I value. And I find I do a lot of talks in schools, and I go in, if I'm talking to most sixth forms, I think kids get a very, very bad press in the UK. I would welcome them being a bigger part of the democratic debate.
I'm doing a television project at the moment which is trying to give more power and more voice to 21-year-olds and under, often 17, 18-year-olds.
Yeah, well, I'm with you on that. I think the mess the world is in. I think my kids are all in the 20s now. I think their generation are the ones that are going to hopefully sort things out.
I find their energy exciting. I feel old when I'm in front of them because their energy is unbelievable. And their intellect.
Well, I'm 60 now, Steve, and I've got loads of energy.
That's because
now, we haven't even talked about my bloody book.
Your book, from Blair to Brown, 2005 to 2007. And unfortunately, look, I've done badly today because I haven't
gone into
the
details. You're a very, very naughty man.
Because I wanted your insight into Northern Ireland, for which I apologise.
Anyway.
But thank you very much.
You better go and buy it anyway.
Okay. Thank you, Alistair.
All the best. Thank you.